Hi, this is Jonathan Worsley, and this is my episode on Smack.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Smack Hospitality Podcast, and most importantly, welcome back to another season. Season 6 is on the horizon. It all starts today with brand new episodes coming your way. The first episode brought us to London, and we met Jonathan Worsley, the mastermind behind the Bench Events. With 30 years of experience in the event business to the hospitality world and being on the board of the World Sustainable Hospitality Alliance, Fresh on Table, Envy Lodges, and prior to that, Rack TDA and STR Global as one of the founders, Jonathan has truly seen it all in the business. Starting IHIF in Berlin 25 years ago, all the way to the Future Hospitality Summit in Dubai, Saudi, and multiple investment conferences in Africa, Jonathan has been organizing investment hospitality conferences around the globe. Some of the great stories are in this episode, the most impressive people Jonathan met along the way, and some of the biggest fails that can happen behind the scenes without any of the attendees noticing. Enjoy the show. Jonathan, I can't tell you how much I haven't looked forward to an episode to recording as much as I have to this one in a long time. Thank you for doing this, first of all, and for being on Smack. I'm going to start with a very easy one. I looked at the Bench. I did something very crazy. I looked at the Bench website yesterday before we started traveling here. 25 years of events, probably more in hospitality. Can you tell me how the event business has changed over those 25 years, just as a warm-up? Because you've done it all. You've done IHIF in Europe some years ago. Then Africa, the Middle East came along. You've seen it. You've seen more people come and go through your stages than probably most other people that have done this. It must have changed. There's no way it's the same business it was 25 years ago.
Yeah, thank you, Fritz. And thank you for this opportunity. It's wonderful.
It's good to have you.
I know you were a few years ahead of my son.
Yes, not so long ago.
He's
one of the spies who I got some stories from. So buckle up for later.
It's nice to have a young leader interviewing me. So that's great.
And this is you. Before we started the recording, you told me usually you're in my seat.
I usually am, but I'm not nearly as good as you.
Okay, stop it. Stop it.
But it's changed dramatically since I've been in the business. And I think one of the most satisfying elements of what I've been able to do or what my team have been able to do is actually go into some of these markets and create these communities where we're bringing the locals and the internationals together to help develop their tourism industry. And that to me has been absolutely the most rewarding thing.
Do you still remember the first event you ever did?
Oh, absolutely. I was terrified. It was IHIF back in 1996, and it was not something that had been done or had even been thought of for Europe anyway. It had been done in the US with NYU and with Jim Berba, who was a great mentor of mine, actually, who created the UCLA Investment Conference, which became ALIS.
Yeah.
But he and I said we should really, through our chairman, Bill Goodnow, at the time at Insignia Hotel Partners, before it became CBRE, we decided to launch this event. And no, we had no organizational skills whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I had some great friends who were helping me, industry friends who were helping me at the time, from Michael Hurst, Trevor Ward, and others.
So let's talk about, before we get into the nitty gritties of what you guys are doing today and how the team's going and everything, let's talk about the beginning. Let's talk about IHIF for a second. When I looked at this and when I went, it felt like a time travel to some extent. I had been born, so I can somewhat relate, but we're talking the late 90s. Hospitality's on the map. It's not nearly as popular as it is today as a business, as an industry, nor was the investment side of it as, let's say, public as it is today. And here comes Johnny Worsley and has a great idea to bring this event to Europe. Walk me through how that came together. You mentioned some names already of people that influenced the whole decision-making process, but how did that come together? And can you say there was a moment where you said, we're doing it. It's happening. We're going to do it.
I think it's like starting your own business, isn't it?
Yeah.
You need to bring in friends around you. You need to bring in mentors around you to help develop and create your vision. And at that point, I had some great mentors who were helping me on that journey.
Yeah.
And we didn't know where it was leading to. And of course, I was a consultant at CBRE.
Yeah.
Eventually, I became a consultant at CBRE before that, PKF and Insignia Hotel Partners. But But they got on board with me as well. Derek Gamage, Michael Hurst, and the team. But also your ex-EHL was fantastic. They got behind it. So we got some key partners that supported us. We had our advisory board, of course, at EHL in Lausanne.
And then that
just got everybody together to make this work, bring the industry together, and to showcase our industry to the investment community primarily.
And that partnership idea, which from what I've got when I read up on the way things have progressed, that partnership idea today to Bench is probably as true as it's ever been, because now, obviously, from the partnerships that you started with, and it's perhaps more a mentoring aspect of the partnership to now, I've been lucky enough to have been invited to some of your events and see it firsthand, the amount of partnerships there and different styles of partnerships, because also the whole partnership idea has changed. And it's not also always necessarily immediately tied to a sponsoring aspect, but that has stayed true to the cause as much as anything else, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think on the organizational piece, probably hasn't changed a great deal. I think we keep kicking ourselves saying, how are we going to innovate? And we, of course, had to innovate pretty quickly during COVID, of course.
We'll get to that.
That whole purpose of meeting people and getting together and workshops and everything else, that hasn't changed. That's a human endeavor, isn't it?
Yeah.
To meet with people. And we really understood that after COVID too. So it's the market has bounced back enormously. But with IHIF, no, we didn't have those organizational skills. We did bring in partners who could help us with that as well.
Sure.
So Advanced R at that point in time. Now Questex were very much part of that journey in the early days and now led by Alexei.
Yeah. Walk me through how in a couple sentences, because we could probably make a podcast just on the IHIF days, but we need to get to the other things as well. Walk me through then the process of IHIF. You must, looking back now, you must sometimes pinch yourself and say that thing took off like a rocket, because to this day, and it's still, set aside that Questix and Alexei are running it now, but to this day, it's still very much connected with what you guys created in the very early days. And it's probably one of the, if not the investment conference in Europe to this day. And everybody wants to go. They're fighting for stand space and so on and so forth. So it's a success story on its own. Was that clearly going to happen after two or three shows? Did you think, okay, if we continue this, if we don't majorly mess it up 10 years down the road, there's a strong chance that this can be a thing? Or was there an element of doubt that kind of came along every year? Are people going to come back?
No, I think it just grew immediately. All the brands supported us. The consultants supported us. And you had, I had the privilege of working with Tess Pearson, for example, for many years. And she was there for 24. She left last year. And so that sort of, that friendship that you created with your clients, with your sponsors, it was very intimate and certainly helped. And yes, no, it just took off. But then back then, it was very much more about, the hotel industry was owner-operator led, and destinations were only just beginning to realize the importance of tourism as a force for good, but also as an economic powerhouse for their developing economies. And you saw the WTTC grow considerably. I helped them with their first event in Vila Moura in Portugal back in the day, bringing the hotel industry into that particular event, and that's gone from strength to strength.
If you, to pick up on that, Johnny, if you look at how hospitality has changed and has really put itself on the map for providing people with incredible experience, whether that's high end or backpack travel and everything in between, is that something that you feel was inevitably going to happen? Or give me your thoughts on that, because probably very few people have seen it develop the way you have from an investment perspective, right? Because let's be honest, part of that development was inevitably capital led or money led, whatever we want to call it, right? It is now a billion-dollar business year-round, and people have understood the economic value of it to the point where countries are now using it to grow their let's say, their image and also their economic powers around it. KSA, we'll get to that in a second. Walk me through how that's changed, because clearly, like I said, 1996, hotels were cool and everything, and it was fun to travel, but it was nowhere near what it is today, no?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think it's really been showcased, the bounce back since COVID as well, the importance of travel as an experience for people. Everybody's had enough of the gadgets they bought, the cars. There's only so many cars you can buy if you're in the luxury element. So you can always spend on those experiences, travel experiences. So that's all led into this huge growth in our industry. And right now, we're only the Chinese are just coming
back.
Yeah,
they're not.
So we're certainly way past 2019 levels,
yeah,
particularly in RevPAR.
Yeah.
And I can only see it's going to continue. Hospitality is, yeah, we're in a good space.
We're in a good space, and we'll talk about that in a second. Walk me through, you know, I need to ask because, hey, I'm from Berlin. There's a connection to me for IHIF, ITB, you know how it goes. Walk me through why Berlin at the later stages in IHIF continued to turn out to be a place where it seemed to be a good place. Was it just the connection with ITB because people were in the city and there was a certain element there? Or why do you think, allow me a little bit of patriotism, why do you think Berlin is and was a fit for IHIF the way that it has been? Because now, obviously, and some people, and I would love your opinion on this as well, as you well know, now it's no longer connected to ITB. So now that the two events are in separate parts of the year, can you give me your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting that because Russell Kett from HVS, yeah, launched the Cornell Hotel Investment Conference, mm-hmm, at the same time that we launched IHIF. And we didn't know
about each other.
So okay, we partnered with you guys. He partnered with Cornell.
Yeah.
And you would think he was probably on the right track because, mm, this is where the investors are. You know, mm, this is the capital of Europe when it comes to finance. So you would think London would work. But of course, it didn't have that networking capability elements, because everybody went home and everything else. So London's always been a bit of a, as a capital city, a bit of a struggle for that. Mm. Whereas Berlin, no one had an office, yeah, from our industry, really, to speak of. Sorry.
But that's true. I can live with that.
Yeah. And so it became a great destination. And we were able to do stuff together. The dinners we had, mm, the events we had. I organized a cycling trip from, mm, Amsterdam to Berlin, raising money for charity. Mm. And you're able to do so much more,
yeah,
when you can get people to stay and create that friendship over a period of time.
Yeah. I'm going to get to the juicy stories that you don't want to talk about in a second because I got them from some of your team and from David Keane, who I need to mention honorably on this because he gave me some stories. But I want to talk about the decision process then, and John, to depart from IHIF and then... And when I spoke to people about you and what you've built and the passion that's gone into events and hospitality, it almost seems like when you speak to people about you leaving Europe, first of all, they miss you. So I'm here to say hello from them. And second of all, it seemed like you were looking for a new challenge, a wider space, probably maybe a more untouched space, because most of what you do now is obviously related to Africa, the Middle East, and so on and so forth. Traditionally, and you have been doing that for some years, as I know, but traditionally markets that perhaps are not as saturated, not as developed as some might consider Europe to be. Was that, and I don't want to get into unnecessary details, but was that part of the reasoning that you were looking for places and projects and also potentially an entire continent with Africa that has got so much potential that is barely or was barely and probably still is barely showcased to the world the same way we showcase Europe, where there's about 20 events per country in hospitality today. Not all our investment, obviously, but the showcase is clearly very different to what's happening in Africa, and Middle East is catching up quickly, but also not perhaps as big and saturated yet as Europe. Was that part of the reasoning? Am I entirely wrong?
I'd done quite a lot of work 25 years ago, particularly in Dubai, mm-hmm, as a consultant. So looking at hotel projects when Sheikhside Road was still a dirt road.
Yes.
And Gerald Lawless, who was opening the Medinet Jumeirah, one, yeah, of the gurus from the region, he said to me, listen, we really need to launch an event in Dubai. Mm. So
when was this? Do you remember the year?
Yeah, this was exactly 20 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, so we started planning
early 2000s.
And yeah, I think FHS, what was AHIC, will be in its 20th year next year. So he said, listen, we need such an event, mm, in the region. So he was a great supporter. We, mm, were the first event at the Medinet Jumeirah when it opened.
Yeah.
And it created a special buzz when we launched that with a, yeah, game. Just awesome experience. We had Prince Al-Walid,
yes,
fly in on his private jet to receive an award, mm, and to speak. We went to one of the islands on the world.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was Greenland. We actually went to, and we had a reception on Greenland.
Wow.
And it was the first, we were nearly the first shipwreck on Greenland, actually, because on the way out,
yeah,
the captain couldn't figure out how to get out from the island. So anyway.
Crazy.
Yeah. But that's been an amazing journey as well, yeah, as have some of these other events that we've launched. Mm. Going into Iran when we did, bringing the internationals, it was all opening up in 2016.
Mm.
That's right. And being in Russia, we were in Russia for about 6 years, six, 7 years. We were in Cuba.
Yeah.
And it's such a shame to see some of these economies or these countries closing collapse, down again, and not opening up their tourism economy.
Yeah. Walk me through some differences that you've seen, and some of them are probably obvious, but I'd love for you to explain because I think you can probably judge this better than anybody else in the business from an event perspective. Walk me through the differences of doing an event or a bench event, whatever one we might want to use, in Africa. And I realize there's differences in Africa depending on where you're going, but let's just take that versus the Middle East versus Europe. Because I imagine, first of all, culturally, that goes without saying, but also the element of hospitality and the openness to receiving people that are potentially foreign but looking to invest. How have you seen that those differences develop? I would imagine the Middle East now fairly familiar with how the business goes. Obviously, Dubai has been around and setting examples probably globally. KSA is trying to quickly catch up. Other countries in the region have been doing the same. How are those differences? Because I imagine your team must be the most culturally experienced events team I could probably find because they deal with so many different places.
Yeah, you need to know your protocol, that's for
yes.
sure. In the developing economies, they usually have a tourism minister to begin with. And whereas in the developed economies, you usually have a junior tourism minister. So the European events are going to tend to be much more private sector led or established economies. Whereas if you're in Africa, you definitely need to have the government behind you, the country behind you, because you need to learn from them as to how they're developing their tourism economy. Yeah. So it's very much more public sector focused. And that also in Saudi with the PIF projects and everything else. So you need to embrace the government and the Ministry of Tourism in that case in Saudi. And they get behind us massively.
Yeah.
Really supportive.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Middle East for a bit, Jonathan. And I want to start with Dubai because you're one of those people that saw it when, as you just said, it was a dirt road, when Sheikh Zayed Road was virtually empty. And if you go there now and FHS World is around the corner, it's only a couple of weeks until the next bench event takes place in the first week of October. And you fly in and there's the lights, the beaches, the beach clubs, the hotels, the economy, the whole place is mind-blowing. If you haven't been, more so than not. Walk me through how you see Dubai's development. I think we can all agree it needs a visionary leader. Otherwise, there's no way you're going to achieve what the country has done in that amount of time with all the ups and downs that were part of it. But that alone doesn't create what has been created.
Yeah, I think you're right. They've had an incredible visionary. And we have bin Said Al Maktoum, who's our founder, our patron, and usually attends the event, gives out the awards and everything else. So they've had wonderful vision to create what they've done. And when you look at the map, you think, it makes sense.
It makes total sense.
Total sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got 3 billion people probably within a couple hours of flight time. And how many places can you go to in the Middle East?
Yeah,
you're going somewhere for the weekend, whereas in Europe it's different.
Yeah.
So no, enormous potential there, and you've just seen an explosive growth of that whole tourism economy, and then the different verticals that now are being attached to it, which makes our job so much fun because we're just a platform basically. We're a platform for investors, developers, operators, brands to come together, consultants, architects, to come together to meet with people, to develop their business, and also to expand that envelope. So right now, for example, because there's a demand for branded residences, we've launched the Branded Residences Forum with Accor Living.
Yeah.
And we've got, I was looking at the numbers the other day, 1,300 units that are being units in the branded residential space, but Dubai is becoming a real center for branded. I think it's the fastest growing region in the world now for branded residences.
Yeah.
Miami is, London, Paris have always been and are big at this as well. So we've got OWO, the owners of OWO in London, the Raffles, coming to speak, talking about this whole emerging market, the branded residences, and the value creation you can get from it. It's anywhere between 20 and 50% if you've got a brand like that on your doorstep with that history and legacy and everything else. It's a really interesting model. So that helps develop a new segment for us, bringing in the residential owners into the event.
Yeah. A quick sidetrack. Have you been to the OWO?
I have. Absolutely amazing.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah.
It's insane. I've been lucky enough to have been as well and visited. What a place. Yeah. We're talking about landmark properties.
Yeah.
Incredible. Back to the Middle East. Sorry, quick sidetrack. Yeah. Talk to me a little bit then about what you guys have seen in the Middle East beyond Dubai. So excluding Dubai from the conversation, and specifically, obviously, talk about KSA. We were in Riyadh together not too long ago when you guys did what I thought was a great event in Riyadh earlier this year. Clearly a country that is putting tourism at the center of their thinking in any capacity that they're working. Walk me through your thoughts on that, and I would love your experiences with speaking to some of the leaders in that tourism vision, because I know from the events and PIF being one of them, but also the ministry and so on and so forth, that you have, you know, spoken to them and they've backed your events and so on and so forth. How do these guys, because that's not somebody that everybody gets a chance to speak to, walk me through how these guys explain their vision to you, because I imagine sometimes even you sit there thinking, oh my God, these guys are really freaking good.
Yeah. It is the most exciting destination in the world right now. If we're talking about Saudi for tourism development, for hotel development, the innovation that's going on, the way it's changed so quickly is just incredible. We used to put on events in Saudi when you had to have a partition between the men and the women.
Yeah.
It was horrendous. Yeah. Separate lifts for men and women. So things have changed enormously. We have a Saudi executive who's based in Saudi, and she's a young national and couldn't be happier with the way things have changed, because they have an opportunity now.
How important is that, John? Because I think you make a very good point there. That whole, because that's something that now when you travel there, people that perhaps go to KSA for the first time, they'll take for granted. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. And it wasn't close either, let's be honest.
No, not at all. And of course, it makes great sense. You need to get the youth employed on board. Yeah. You need the women on board. Otherwise, you don't have an industry.
Yeah.
And so we've been really playing with that as well and supporting that initiative by getting more women in the workforce, by having our Women Power campaign, increasing the number of women participants at all our events, but especially with Saudi. So we were quite pleased. I think this year we achieved about 28%, 30% of our delegates were women. Really focus on the speakers as well, moderators bringing in women to participate.
Yeah. Sidetrack, this is going to be a podcast of sidetracks. I just saw, I think yesterday, there was an email going around that you have, to back up what you just said, that you guys are strongly involved in empowering women to join this. I think there was an email going around, and I'm going to look at somebody who's in the room behind the camera. I think there's an email going around that for FHS World, Emirati nationals can join the FHS World event for free. Am I completely?
Day special.
Emirati Women's Day special. There we go.
That's right.
Ali behind the camera. Thank you so much, sir.
Yeah, a lot of activity.
A lot of activity going around. Right. Can I ask about the culture aspect in that regard? When you talk about the youth and getting on everybody on board, is that something, in your opinion, bit of a provocative question, but bear with me, that in Europe sometimes is forgotten? Because I feel like a lot of other cultures are better at getting their, let's call it troops in the best of senses, behind them when it comes to a vision, especially related to tourism and hospitality. Is that something that sometimes we're forgetting a little bit in Europe? Because if you look at Mallorca, for example, people are now protesting. Barcelona, there's locals that have sat in bars until tourists have left because they don't want over tourists. Is there a challenge there that we've perhaps overlooked in Europe, in your opinion? Or is that too far?
I think the vision. In the UK, we don't have a vision for tourism, so God knows what's happening here. Mm. Not that I run an event in the UK, but I'm based here. So you don't know what the vision is, whereas we know exactly what the vision is for Saudi or Dubai. And I think that's the same with the rest of Europe, too. They need to control the tourists as well. Yeah. Over-tourism is a serious issue. And I've spoken to the UNTO about this as well, and looking at how are you going to manage this? We need to come together to deal with this. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more, and I think it's very clear that Europe has a bigger challenge there. I want to ask you a question, before we come to the... In my notes, I have a line halfway through the paper with all the juicy bits at the bottom that I got from friends and colleagues and people that have been with you for a while that I want to get through. But before I do, explain to me, in as simple words for somebody who's not from the event sector, the business of doing events and the business of, as you said, I thought that was a beautiful sentence you just said, of being a platform, because essentially that's how you and I think a lot of your team see yourselves. Has that become easier or more complicated? in a global sense. I know we can look at this from different points of view, but I imagine with the way the world works today, it's certainly more globalized, which I would imagine makes it a little bit easier, but there's also a lot more participants in that mix, in that hospitality mix. So how is it now organizing an FHS world, and do you get a little bit of more gray hair than not doing it, or how does that run?
I think it's become immensely more difficult, more challenging. And of course, you've got a lot of competition out there as well. So you need to stay on top of your game. And so you need to continue to innovate and use us as a platform. So I'm always open. I'm always open.
To ideas there.
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
But it is, and it's thrilling to be, to have such partners where we can be the platform for the sustainable hospitality challenge. For example, Paul Grebe and Stella, what they put on is remarkable.
It's my first topic. So let's talk right about it. Let's dive right in. When I was at the first first of your events in outside of Europe, because I had been to IHF outside of Europe, I vividly remember this. It was an event in Abu Dhabi. You remember this as well. It was a year and a half ago, I think, or something like that, or a little bit less. The one thing that stood out to me was that you're actively trying to do things that, with all due respect, have absolutely nothing to do with the investment community. Sustainability challenge, you got a group of students from the Emirates Academy. And when I say group, I'm not talking five people, because I was one of the people that you asked to go on stage to speak to them. There was 200 students that you got to get to attend to the event, to speak to some experts, me excluded, in that room, which I thought, and you didn't charge the students a dime. Walk me through the importance when you do that, because doing an event is one thing, and clearly something that you have mastered over time. And you're not gonna throw in that. But all the other things, there's a startup challenge. There's, you know, you do so much on the side. Why, if I may ask? Because you don't have to. You've proven to the world that you know how to do it. Is it something that you just enjoy doing, or is it?
Yeah, I think you're right. It is certainly something I do enjoy doing.
Yeah, I can tell by looking in your face right now. Yeah.
I do enjoy doing that. But on the other hand, we do need to stay focused as well. And our community is coming there. We're bringing the investors and if we change that too much, that's not going to work either. I think this year we've got $3.5 trillion worth of value in terms of delegates, hotel assets that are participating in the event. So we need to look after our core audience. But of course, those owners also have these issues with innovation, with sustainability, with education. And so what is it that destination or that country? So in Saudi, it's very much education. That's their key challenge at the moment, is bringing youth into our sector. Otherwise, how are they going to manage these hotels?
Yeah.
So we're launching the Education Investment Forum alongside FHS Saudi, working with the government on this and everything else. It's absolutely a key to ultimately the owners, who need to know what's happening with AI. For example, we've got a great AI person in the room.
So I've heard.
And this is an explosive area here. AI, there's so much for us to learn. And not many of us are actually paying any attention.
I was going to say, not many people in the business are paying any attention to it.
Any attention to it.
Yeah, I agree.
And what the McKinsey survey recently just came out said that the... by 2030, the global economy is going to grow by 13 trillion. That's a result of, but we don't know anything about it.
Yeah.
80% of us don't touch it.
Is that a problem we have in hospitality sometimes? Are we too focused sometimes? Are we not looking? Because clearly the bench events with all the side projects, if you don't mind me calling them, is a good example on how we should be looking at hospitality. Yes, there's a core business, which is your investors, and it's a numbers game at the end, let's not pretend. But then there's other elements that we try and educate ourselves in the process, and something that you guys are trying to incorporate. If we're honest, Jonathan, not a lot of people in the industry are doing that. Most people in the industry are going about their business and they're very good at what they do, but they very rarely look beyond what else is happening. Is that a hospitality problem? Is that just a generational problem?
I don't think it's hospitality necessarily. I think it's all industries.
Yeah.
And it's something we're going to have to learn and breathe with. I think it's a massive opportunity in this space. Because I think you probably have two elements here. You've got those that are looking at it, but aren't doing anything with it. Mm. And CEOs, like 80% of CEOs, say this is incredibly important that we do something with it, but we aren't generally doing anything. So, and then you've got the tech space where they're very much focused on it, but it's too tech oriented. It's an interesting area, that whole space.
I have gotten two time warnings already and I haven't even touched my list of juicy parts that I want to look at. So let me run through it. I spoke to some people that have been with you, friends, mostly friends of yours, people, colleagues that have been working for you while. And I was told to ask the important questions this afternoon, Jonathan. The Catholic Awards ceremony, there's a legendary story there that I need you to share. Dr. Gurr, would you mind sharing the story? I found a beautiful video from 13 years ago. Would you mind sharing what happened with us?
I think that's very unfair of my colleagues.
Of your colleagues, yes.
To bring that up. Incredibly unfair. But because this was a bit of a slip up, and I was supposed to be giving an award. I gave an award to the wrong person, ultimately.
And there's a great video, which we will put a small slider in it. But I thought the way, and we'll put the video in the recording as well, because it's on YouTube. The way you did it, because you introduced, so for everybody that's listening to this at home, you asked a guy on stage who was meant to give the award, correct? Is that what happened?
That's right.
And then you gave the award to the person.
And he accepted it.
Which was the best part. And in fact, he leaves the stage with the award. And he pretends nothing's wrong with it. And then he comes back. Hilarious story. Isn't that the beauty of what you do as well, to some extent? Is that there's we could probably do 2 hours of podcast just with stories that you've experienced at these events, no?
Oh, no. And also some of the speakers we've had too.
Give me your top three. Let me put you on the spot here.
No, for sure. I've always loved exploring. Mm-hmm. My parents, they left the UK for Canada, bought a log cabin. They were explorers.
Okay.
And having the likes of Sir Ranulph Fiennes participate and talk about his travels. So I've had him numerous times. A distant relative of mine, Henry Worsley, he walked across the Antarctic, was about to be the first man to do it. Unfortunately, he didn't quite make it 10 miles from crossing. He passed away. Mm. He was in his late 50s. Mm. But I had him speak, and he was talking about the Shackleton voyage 100 years on, because his ancestor, and maybe mine, I'm not entirely sure, was a skipper of Endurance on that boat. So I've always loved bringing in these speakers and learning from them.
It speaks volumes that you mentioned, with all the incredible people that you've had and very senior people and politicians, that you pick out to people that have some form of experiential travel story to tell. That speaks volumes. Let me ask about something else. Giordano at the Yanbu Mall. What happened there? Can we talk about that on the podcast?
Sorry, explain.
David Keane says hello at Giordano at the Yanbu Mall.
It's been a great tradition. David and I from Quo have been traveling around Saudi after each Saudi event.
Yes.
And getting to know it.
And I'm going to talk about that as well in a second. Yeah, okay. Go on.
No, but it's just silly that he left first thing in the morning, was in a room with his son, Paul, and didn't want to turn on the lights, so forgot to take his luggage with him.
Oh,
he only had a couple of t-shirts.
Oh, boy.
And
sounds like
I had to take him to a mall to buy some clothes.
Okay, very good. I want to talk to you before, as we come to the end, because just like that, 35 minutes have passed. And we could do this for 2 hours, Jonathan, but unfortunately, there is a time limit to this. Talk to me about this travel, because it's also something that a colleague of yours has mentioned to me, that your trips with David, for example, and through KSA, and it's also something that you wouldn't necessarily have to do. But when I speak to people who know you, they say the guy genuinely cares about where he's going and doing business. So how was it experiencing the country, and we're clearly talking about Saudi in this case, in places, and you didn't just go to Riyadh and Jeddah and places where everybody can take a plane to, but you took a car and went out of your way to go to the countryside. Walk me through that.
I think it's just earning a bit of respect as well when you're going to someone's country to learn a little bit about their country as well. So when we were in Iran, I took my son and a number of delegates skiing in the Elbrus Mountains. And that was a great experience, which I'll never forget.
I would imagine
there's a whole bunch of stories.
There's
a whole story on that one.
We'll come back.
And it's just seeing for real what is going on. Yeah. And it's a remarkable country, Saudi. It's really thrilling. So this year we went to Asir. Mm. And we have Asir Development Authority as one of our sponsors at FHS. And it's a beautiful country. People think of Saudi as desert, whereas Asir is beautiful. It's mountainous, lots of culture and history there. It's similar to Oman, Yemen, in terms of the features. So no, we love doing that sort of stuff. And we do it for our delegates as well. Yeah. So we have these experiences. So we work with the likes of Fresh on Table, who I know you've interviewed, Atul Chopra, for example. I sit on his board. I love what he's doing in that whole sustainability piece. But again, he'll provide those experiences for us that all the food is produced locally. And we'll do. And we'll do that at FHS. Yeah. So
great stories. Final piece that I want to talk about. Tell me about the Golden Gnome Award song and the fellas that got on stage. And I have the copyrights of the song. Has anyone seen our John?
Oh, yeah. That was...
I have all the stories, trust you me. Our research is flawless.
That was Russell Kett playing the piano. So I used to organize the advisory board. We used to have a dinner in London for 500, 600
at the Metropole.
At the Metropole. Yeah. And it was just a way of getting together in between China and everything else. And I'd often have my charity, Future Talent, that I sit on the board of. They'd come and sing and try to raise money for them. But this particular time, Russell Kett put this ditty together with
Jamie Chappell,
I think probably Derek Gamage, maybe Michael Hurst. They were all singing.
We have the video. We'll put that in the recording as well.
I can't believe you brought that
up. We've got it all. John, listen, thank you for your time. This was a breath of fresh air. I would love to do this again at some point, but you need to crack on first and foremost with other things. Best of luck with everything that's coming. FHS World, like I said, is around the corner, a couple days away in Dubai, starts October 1st, September 30th, something like that.
September 30th. To the 2nd of October.
To the 2nd of October. We'll put the website in the description of the episode as well.
Okay.
Best of luck. Thank you for your time, Johnny, and we'll see you soon.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye.
That's it for this episode, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Don't forget to share your thoughts on this episode and everything else that is going on at SMAC with us by checking out our website at smac.media or connect with us on LinkedIn, YouTube, or Instagram. We'll see you next time.